The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we'll be featuring storyteller extraordinaire Rabbi Yerachmiel Tillis, all the way from Safat, Israel. Recently came out with a new book called Saturday Night, Full Moon, Volume 1, implying that there's going to be some more volumes. I think it's going to be a trilogy, as a matter of fact. We're going to talk about the uniqueness of storytelling, believe it or not. We've got wonderful Jewish music for you in this hour of the show. There was one request, yes. The portion of the week is the portion of Balak, chapter 22, and following in the book of Numbers. Somewhere I'm going to tell a Hasidic story. I'm not sure if it'll be at the end like I normally do it, or because we're talking about Hasidic stories, it might come up in the course of conversation, but I'm going to tell my favorite Hasidic story today. That's my goal. Somewhere in between now and the end of the hour, you'll hear my favorite Hasidic story. And before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Israel's Security Service identified Amir Abu Aisha and Marwan Kawasami, both of Hebron, as the kidnappers of the three Israeli teens. The suspects have been missing since the June 12th kidnap. Gilad Sha'ar, Eyal Yifrach, and Naftali Frankel were abducted from a junction in the Gush Etzion settlement block south of Jerusalem. IDF forces continued their search for the three abducted teens in Operation Brothers Keeper, arresting 87 more terrorists this week. Among the arrested was a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council for Hamas, Khalid Tafesh, who was caught in Bethlehem. Security forces, is an interesting switch on things. Security forces took 10 Palestinians from the Balata refugee camp to local Israeli hospitals after the 10 Palestinians were injured in riots against IDF soldiers. A French court in Marseille ordered the extradition of Maïdou Nemouche, the Frenchman suspected of killing four people at the Jewish Museum in Brussels, back to Belgium. Nemouche has been in police custody on suspicion of murder, attempted murder, and possession of weapons since his arrest on May 30th, 1 week after the attack. 40 gravestones at the Jewish cemetery in Manchester, England, were toppled and anti-Semitic graffiti and swastikas were scrawled on the graves. No suspects are anywhere near to being found. The House Foreign Affairs Committee approved a law to keep international banks from doing business with Hezbollah. The Hezbollah International Financing Prevention Act of 2014, introduced by Representatives Mark Meadows, a Republican of North Carolina, and Brad Schneider, a Democrat from Illinois, includes a provision to sanction foreign banks that knowingly aid the activity of the Lebanese militia party. Neir Tzedek Synagogue of Northeast Philadelphia was vandalized with spray-painted swastikas. The event was captured on surveillance tape, and ongoing investigation is on the way. The U.S. will consider a deal to release Jonathan Pollard from prison. He's been in prison for like 28 years already. Israeli President Shimon Peres met with Obama this week, and he said that he discussed Pollard's case with President Obama, and Obama said that the U.S. Attorney General would consider his offer. Keep posted for that one. And finally, listen to this one. The Russian Jewish Congress is looking to enter the Guinness Book of World Records for recording the longest song using the most amount of singers. A three-hour rendition of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah features 5,775 singers, including Russian billionaires and movie stars, the number 5775, equaling the upcoming new Jewish New Year of 5775. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Hey, Schulfenman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We are online with storyteller extraordinaire, Rabbi Yerachmiel Tillis, a friend of mine, all the way from Safat, Israel. How are you, Yerachmiel?
I'm fine, Baruch Hashem. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking up time. Busy. I know you're getting ready for everything that you're getting ready for. Before we get into storytelling, which is really what the focus of today's interview is about, the big news over here are the three teens, and I'm wondering, what's the word on the ground in Israel now?
The word on the ground is nobody knows what's going on still. The government claims to have information that they know they're alive, but they're not sharing. Nobody really knows what's going on. Everybody's praying.
Okay, that's the same over here. So I guess we're as up to date as you are as well.
Right.
Well, we're praying for their speedily return in an unharmed manner, and all good things. Okay, storytelling. Okay, this seems to be the central. There's this like central mystique among Hasidim and storytelling. Could you give us a little bit of the skinny on storytelling, please, Yerachmiel Tillis?
I don't feel it to be a mystique so much. I mean, it's a strong tradition. The storytelling fills in a lot of gaps. It helps to understand the tradition better. It helps to inspire us, hearing about the lives of great Jews. It gives something to aim for, and we can find models in the stories and. And plus, you know, everybody loves a good story.
Okay, indeed. But in among Hasidim, stories about the tzaddikim, the righteous leaders of the past, and great men who lived throughout the millennia, they're looked at more than just, say, like folklore or even to say chas v'shalom mythology. What makes a Hasidic story a Hasidic story, other than the fact that it's a Hasidic person telling it about a Hasidic person?
Oh, well, well, there's always, from a Hasidic story, there's always something to learn. It's not primarily entertainment. It's primarily a facet of Torah, a way of communicating Torah values or Torah information. Yeah, it's not, we don't consider it fiction. We consider it real.
Okay, now, there's a famous statement about Baal Shem Tov stories.
Right.
Whether this statement was ascribed to whomever, but it seems I remember hearing this line 40 years ago, even before I was involved with religion, is that anybody who believes every Baal Shem Tov story is a fool, but to deny any Baal Shem Tov story would make the person an apostate. So what's the deal with stories about righteous people, for example, that do we have to believe them, as far-fetched as they may sound? I'm going to ask you specifically about one which we told here on the Jewish Hour a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit exaggerated the way you presented it, but it definitely.
That's the way I heard it as a kid.
I'll give you the original quote. It's in the back of my book.
Uh-huh.
Saturday Night Full Moon, from Rabbi Moshe of Kabrin. We must believe all the stories, miracles, and wonders attributed to the Baal Shem Tov. We should believe that even if they didn't happen, they could have happened.
Okay.
So that's the basic principle. I can tell a story to bring up this point. Story is a very short thing, even from the non-Hasidic world. The Chafetz Chaim, he was.
Could you explain who the Chafetz Chaim was?
Yeah, the Kofetz Chaim was a great, the leader of the Lithuanian sages. He passed away in the 1930s. His books on halacha are as authoritative as any books of halacha in Jewish history. He was a very important sage. And he was introduced in a court case in Russia as a character witness. And his reliability as a witness was challenged by the prosecuting attorney. So the defending attorney told this story that the Chofetz Chaim was intending to mail a letter to someone when somebody passed by that was going to the town where this other person lived and took the letter. He volunteered to deliver the letter personally. Chofetz Chaim gave him the letter. And then the postage stamp that he had purchased to send this letter that he didn't need, he tore it up. He didn't want to deprive the government of making the money on its stamp. So the judge said to the lawyer, "Oh, come on, you don't expect me to believe there's somebody that really did that." So the defense lawyer said, "Judge, I can't guarantee you that that really happened, but one thing I can tell you, they're not telling that story about you or me."
Okay, very interesting.
So at least that these stories can be told about the Baal Shem Tov or any of the great tzaddikim, and that at some level they can be believed. It's already teaching us something amazing about these great Jews, something inspiring about these great Jews.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a reputation as a storyteller. And I go very often, when I need a story, I go to ascent.com/stories, where there are archived probably close to 1,000 stories that you've told. And you have a reputation of having authenticated every story that appears on the website. Is that a valid rumor?
It's not a rumor started by me. I mean, I do my best to track track down facts, or at least to know where the story is coming from, but I can't promise that. I don't even know if that's possible, but I certainly can't promise.
Okay,
that
given that caveat,
I try to avoid stories where it's about the Rebbe and the Chassid, and you know, anonymous stories about people without names and in anonymous villages and whatever.
Okay.
Go on.
Go ahead. Okay. If you're just tuning in, our guest is your Rabbi Rachmiel Tillis. He is a storyteller, among all the other things. He just came out with a book, Saturday Night Full Moon, Volume 1. And I'm understood to believe that there's going to be a Volume 2 and Volume 3. It's from Menorah Press.
Right.
We told a story here that I got off your website a couple weeks ago. About certain, just to get to the gist of the story, there was a rabbi who was living in a city that I never heard of, which, as I say, someplace, you're a former Detroiter, someplace east of Grosse Pointe Farms is the way I describe this city. Zeville, I can't even say the city, Zeville. And he moved to Yerushalayim after he got older.
Yeah.
And this man resurrected somebody who died with a spoonful of Sabbath stew. So I really would like to know knowing that you tell stories that you can sort of back up, that story sounds far-fetched. Could you give us the background on that story, that specific story, Rabbi Tillis?
Well, there's three ways to deal with this. One, you can apply the formula you had before. Well, even if it isn't true, it could have been true. The Zvil Rebbe is pretty unknown in American circles, but in Israel he was considered one of the very, very big tzaddikim of the generation. Another is to just, if it's been passed along from his Talmud, again, we have to make a distinction between the Baal Shem Tov, who lived 250 years ago, and somebody who lived 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
or actually 70 years ago. You know, there's people around, or descendants of people around that heard the story, of course, from the time it's supposed to happen. So you can just take it at face value and believe it. But in this particular story, I think there's a third possibility. What was the story? It's that the people came home from shul, and found him lifeless on the ground, and because he had swallowed a piece of challah the wrong way. So he went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, give him this piece of challah, give him this spoonful of challah. So it could be that he wasn't really dead.
Uh-huh.
That's also possible. And also the way the story was phrased, and this is what I tried to be very careful about keeping it as it was in the original, he wasn't really alive. He wasn't really brought back to life. I used the expression, he was like
a zombie-like state, yes.
Yeah. In other words, he wasn't really alive. He was animated. He was animated in some form to be able to move from one house to another house, presumably, which didn't take very long, and he collapsed in his own house.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, so if you would have
not exactly bringing somebody from death to life. It's still pretty wild. But
I'm sure, had you asked Rabbi Shlomo Goldman if he had actually done this, he probably would have denied it. Would that be a correct assumption, Yerachmiel?
I would think so.
Okay, I understood. Okay, now, the book that you've written is called Saturday Night. Okay,
yes.
Why did you call a book about stories Saturday Night?
In general, Saturday night is a traditional time for telling stories at the Saturday night meal, the meal of King David. But more specifically, in my instance, is for 30 years, on most Saturday nights, I've been telling stories at a institute in Tzfat where I work. And it's really been a kind of laboratory for my stories. People will often compliment me by saying that your stories read as if you're speaking. Well, that's what it is. I mean, all these stories, I've spoken them numerous times, and I adjust the written versions afterwards according to how I see people react to them when I tell them. So Saturday night is a very, very significant part of my storytelling.
Uh-huh. So this is like Saturday Night Live with Yerachmiel Tillis.
Well, it's interesting you said that, because that's how I introduce it every Saturday. I say, welcome to Saturday Night Live at Ascent. That's how I always start off.
Okay, we're on the same page.
So Baruch Hashem Kavanta.
Okay, now, there's zillions of stories out there. Lots of stories are already published in other works. Shlomo Zevin went to great lengths to come out with a compendium of Tales of the Hasidim, which is an absolutely marvelous book. It was my first book of a compendium of Hasidic stories. And whenever,
who are we talking about? I didn't catch it.
Shlomo Zevin.
Oh yeah, that's
Tales of the Hasidim in English, Diporei Hasidim in Hebrew. Oh. Yeah, so they occupy a prominent place on my shelf, and I used it regularly as a resource until the internet came out and made things much more easier for us. What's your criteria for telling a Hasidic story? Why do you choose whatever story that you tell? And furthermore, what got it into the book?
Okay, in general, I would say that my feelings about criteria are pretty much based on Rav Zevin's introduction to it in his book. I'm glad you brought them up. I mean, I have lots and lots of storybooks, as you might imagine. And when people ask me to recommend Hasidic storybooks, those are the only ones I ever recommend. And this was one of the greatest scholars of the 20th century, and he bothered himself to compile books of stories. It's got to be significant. And he says in his introduction, he tried to track things down as best as he could. And there's no, you don't find any exaggeration in the way he tells things. And me personally, so I look for stories that it makes the people in the story seem like real human beings, rather than stereotypes or caricatures. And I'm always looking for a human interest element.
Mm-hmm.
And for something that sounds real. I'm very, in storytelling, I'm a very big follower of the previous Lubavitcher, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, who, as you know, went to great lengths to provide all kinds of details until it becomes almost possible not to believe what he's saying. There's so many details.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed. One of the things, my wife, Hannah, who you know very well, she was a student of yours, actually, back in all of our younger days.
Right.
When I tell this Hasidic story, she gets kind of irked by the stories where they live happily ever after. And so I refrain from the story where the guy comes to the Rebbe and says, I have no money. And the Rebbe tells them, jump up and down three times or whatever it is. And the guy suddenly finds a vast fortune and they live happily ever after. Those stories do seem more like fables because actually next week, here's a plug for next week's show. I'm having a person on who's going to be talking about, he's a historian at the Northwestern University, who wrote a book about the shtetl and sort of demystified the shtetl and took the mystique out of the shtetl. And shtetls and shtetl life and living in the Pale of Settlements and life for the Hasidim in Russia, White Russia, the Ukraine, Poland, it's the Hungary, Russia. Life was terrible. It was really awful, which is why there was such a mass migration of Jews from that area to the United States from the 1818s to the 1920s. So what is it with stories where, at the end, the protagonist lives happily ever after, Rabbi Yochum Yaltilis?
Well, I think your wife will like my book. It struck me, last week somebody was complaining to me that my stories don't have clear morals to them. And I should tell him which stories have clear morals and which don't. So I had to like whiz through all of them, and it struck me that I have for a storybook, I have a significant number of stories that don't have happy endings. They have real endings, but they're not necessarily happy endings. Look, a certain number of people look to stories for comfort, you know, as you said, people were suffering so much, you know, and they don't need to hear a story about people suffering. You know, they have the real thing, you know, they don't need more suffering. But I agree with her, and one thing I tend to avoid is most Holocaust stories, the ones that involve in people being miraculously rescued or miraculously surviving. Because you know, it's such a small minority of people that happened to. And sure, it's a bracha for them, a blessing for them that it happened. But it stands in the face of an overwhelming number that didn't make it. I have two Holocaust stories in the book, but neither of them involve somebody. Well, one of them is a very sad story, and I stay away from happy endings with Holocaust stories.
Understood. Is it possible with all the stories that you know and you've told that you have a favorite story, Yochum Yaltilis?
I get asked that. I always have a favorite story at the time because when I tell stories, I try to use the first Lubavitcher Rebbe's guideline about living with the times, and I'm always looking for stories that relate to the time of the year. It's the Rebbe's Yahrzeit, so there's a time for Lubavitcher Rebbe stories, or something with the Torah reading, or something with the holiday it just was, or soon will be. So it tends to fluctuate, but there's one story in my book called Silence Speaks. Every time I tell it, I tend to choke up.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell it first now, please?
That must be a special story for me. Huh?
Tell it first now, please.
Tell it?
Yes, please.
It could take a while.
You have 4 minutes.
Well, that's enough to start, but okay. I won't get to the finish. the vision of the Rebbe at the turn of the century, around the year 1900, so he used to go each evening for a stroll. He would walk from his house accompanied by one of his attendants all the way through the town to the end of the main street, which ended at a park, the city park. And then they would turn around and go back. It's Rabbi Yisrael Heger, born in 1860, passed away in 1936. And one time, they're walking along, he and the attendant, and they come to the end, just before the end, and all of a sudden, the Rebbe darts up the steps to the house that's situated right next to the park, which, as you can imagine, is the most expensive real estate area in the city. And it was a mansion-like house belonging to the manager of the bank. And the attendant couldn't understand why the Rebbe would be going into this house. The manager of the bank was like the leader of, it was what was called the Reform Movement, but it's the Reform Movement then was different than the Reform Movement now. It's very aggressively anti-Orthodox. And so why would the Rebbe be going into that house? But on the other hand, he saw the door open, the Rebbe started in, he wasn't going to be left out, so he zoomed over and he followed the Rebbe into the house. So the servant who opens the door goes to, welcomes him in, shows him into the salon, the living room, and the Rebbe sits down in a chair, and he runs upstairs to tell the bank manager that the Hasidic Rebbe is here. And the bank manager can't understand why. But he comes running down the stairs, and he pulls up a chair opposite the Rebbe and sits down, so they're sitting face to face, so we can hear what the Rebbe wants. The Rebbe doesn't say anything. He just sits there. And the bank manager can't figure out what's going on. And he manages to catch the eye of the Rebbe's attendant, and he gives him like a signal, and he excuses himself to the Rebbe, and he meets with the attendant out in the hall and says, "Why did he come here? What does he want?" The attendant says, "I don't know what he wants. He didn't say anything to me. I just followed him in." So he goes back and sits down opposite the Rebbe, and he sits there, and the Rebbe sits there. He doesn't want to challenge the Rebbe, "What do you want?" It's not, whether he likes it or not, he's a host, and that's not polite. That's not being polite to the guests. He can't offer him food or drink. He knows he's not going to take it. And so he waits for the Rebbe to say what he wants to say, and the Rebbe says nothing. 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10, 15 minutes go by. And then the Rebbe gets up, goes to where the servant hung his coat on a hook, takes his coat, walks out the door. The attendant goes running after him. And after a moment's thought, the manager goes running after them. he has to escort his guests also. But he goes down the steps after them and follows them all the way down the street until they get to where the Rebbe lives. Nobody says a word. The Rebbe starts up the steps to his house, and the bank manager calls out, "Vishnah to Rebbe, until now you were my guest. I didn't want to be so rude as to challenge you. Why did you come to my house? But now we're at your house. So tell me, why did you come to my house? What? And come in and sit down and not say a word, 15 minutes, and then walk out. What's going on?" The Rebbe turned around and says to him very gently, "I came to your house to make a mitzvah. And Baruch Hashem, I did it." Turns away to go walk in his door. And the bank manager screams out, "This is the Rebbe. What is the mitzvah? What happened? What's going on here? What mitzvah did you come to make?" The Rebbe said, "Okay, look, I'll tell you. There's a mitzvah, it says in chapter 19 in Leviticus, you shall rebuke your fellow Jew. And why is the verb doubled? So usually it's just for emphasis, but the rabbis tell it here to tell us you have to do again and again. Rebuke your fellow Jew if you see them doing something against, ideally in accordance with the Torah. So you have to try to convince them to do the right thing and keep trying. The border, the limit though is as long as there is a possibility that they'll listen to you, that they will change the way they're behaving. But if the opposite is the case, that it's 100% sure they're not going to listen, and what's more, they're going to lose respect for you or for the Torah, that then it's not a good thing to be doing. If it's like this, disgracing the Torah, disgracing God's name in public. So to such a person, you shouldn't say anything." So the Rebbe said, "So what does that mean? You sit home and you don't say anything?" "No, you have to go up to the person and not say anything." So that's what I did. Baruch Hashem, I made my mitzvah. So by now the bank manager is going a little crazy from all of this. He calls out, "Rebbe, how did you know that I wouldn't listen? What is it? What is it that I wouldn't listen to?" The Rebbe said, "I can't tell you. Otherwise I'll lose my mitzvah. My mitzvah was not to tell." "But how did you know I wouldn't listen?" I know. "But how could you possibly know? Tell me, what is it?" And they went back and forth like this for a little while, and finally the Rebbe said, "Okay, I'll tell you." What did he tell them? He said, today a poor widow came to my house. A year or two ago, her husband passed away. And since then, she hasn't been able to make the mortgage payments to your bank. And now she received a notice from your bank that they're going to foreclose next week if she doesn't pay, in this coming week if she doesn't pay, and she and her children will be out on the street. So she's Jewish, I'm Jewish, you're Jewish. She came to me as the Rebbe and as the Rav of the town that maybe I could influence you that the bank should be merciful. So the bank manager said, Rebbe, you don't understand. I'm the manager of the bank, but I don't set policy. I'm under the directors of the entire bank system. The directors live in the main office in the main city, and I take orders from them. I don't decide anything. The Rebbe said, I told you I knew you wouldn't listen, and now I lost my mitzvah. And he went into his house and closed the door. The bank manager went home and couldn't stop thinking about this. He was awake the whole night. In the morning, he went into the bank and paid the mortgage out of his own pocket.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a way not to tell somebody. Okay, that's going to do it for us. We appreciate you coming on. The book is Saturday Night Full Moon by Rabbi Rachmiel Tillis, published by Menorah. It's available on Amazon and wherever fine Jewish books are sold. Yeah. And thank you so much.
Only 4 minutes.
Yeah, indeed. And well, thank you so much for coming on. And continued success, and we're waiting for volumes 2 and 3.
Okay.
Take care.
Volumes 2 of the old holiday store. Shabbat Shalom.
Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break and be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herr Schulfenman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Next up, a little light music. This is Avram Fried, Lo Yavah Kadosh Baruch Hu, that God's not coming down, or God is not going to enter the temple up in heaven until the temple down here is built. And this is just for you.
Amar Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lo Yavoi Ad She'avoi Amar Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lo Yavoi Ad She'avoi Lo Yerushalayim shelanu Oyot she'avoy Yerushalayim shelmato Lo, lo, yavoy שאובו נפסוליים שמתו לאי לאי אבוי נפסוליים שלמנו ויום שאובוי נפסוליים שמתו לאי לאי אבוי נפסוליים שלמנו עד שאובוי ירושלים שמתו
Play it, Danny, play it.
Amar, Amar, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lo yavoy Ad she'ovoy Hoy lo yavoy Yerushalayim shel malo Yerushalayim shemato Loi, loi, avoy Yerushalayim shemato Ad she'ovoy Yerushalayim shemato
Ad she'ovoy Ay, 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 loy, loy, avoy Ad she'ovoy Loy, loy, avoy Ad she'ovoy
Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We got up next. This is Reb Shaya, and he's doing a medley of Hasidic, of Klezmer classics. Let's listen in. Thank you.
Arts Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Arts Studio of Oak Park is something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Arts Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Arts Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Hey, Shelton, here you're listening to the Jewish Hour. We got time for one more. This is Laser Lloyd, who was in town just recently. We'll be coming back in August sometime. And one of the participants at the Laser Lloyd function concert asked me if I could play Kar B'Yerushalayim, which means it's cold in Jerusalem. Here it is, just for you.
Kar B'Yerushalayim V'ha'am Tel Aviv Kar B'Yerushalayim V'ha'am Ha'am B'Tel Aviv יא לפעמים הרואים בחוץ יכול להיות הפוך, הפוך בפנים כמו ציירתי בטיילת היום אני עומד מול הכותל המערבי תיילתי בתיילת היום אני עומד מול הכותל המערבי לפעמים אני מרגיש כמו ילד ולפעמים אני סופר את השנים ואת את התקווה שלי איך לחבר את שני הפכים כמו לימון ותפוז כמעט אותו דבר לא בדיוק אבל את התקווה שלי
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Balak. And
It's in chapter 22 and following in the book of Numbers. Last week, we left off. The Jews are marching through what would be today Saudi Arabia and Jordan on their way to the promised land, conquering hither and thither in Hillendale, and just like unstoppable. Somewhere off the side in like southern Saudi Arabia was the country of Midian. And the Midianites were afraid that the Jews are going to conquer them too. But the Jews really had no interest in going to Midian because it's the wrong way. They're going west, and this was south. So it's like totally out of the way. Why they would think that they should go and attack the Jewish people? Well, it's talked about later on when the Jews actually did attack the Jewish people, as the Jews did actually attack the Midianites. As a result of what happens in this week's portion, that the Midianites were just blatant anti-Semites. Nothing else. There was nothing else to it. They weren't afraid of anything. They had nothing to do with the Jews. Absolutely. They had no reason. They just hated Jews. Okay. So what did they do? They hired a prophet by the name of Bilaam. In English, for some reason, Bilaam became Balaam. And I'm not exactly sure how Bilaam became Balaam. But you could say like everything else. His Hebrew name was Bilaam and his English name was Balaam. He was a prophet, a non-Jewish prophet, who was rooted in the forces of evil. And as holy as Moses was, that's how evil Bilaam was. And as great of a level of prophecy did Moses experience, that's how great a level of prophecy that Bilaam experienced. Because we're told, Zelu Mazeh Aselakim, the world is made in a state of equilibrium. God made everything balanced, the forces of good, the forces of evil, even though it may look that evil is much more powerful than good, but the forces of good, the forces of evil are equal. And whenever there's something like really outstandingly good and holy, there's going to be something really outstandingly evil, drawing from the forces of evil. It's very interesting to note that the concept of the Messiah appears one time in the first five books of Moses. And that's in this week's portion. In a prophecy, a soliloquy that you want to say, an oration, whatever it was, that he was inspired, this Bilaam character was inspired to say, where he alluded to the coming of the Messiah. It's towards the end of the portion, after he realizes that he's not going to be able to curse the Jews like he's been hired to. He gives them one more plug. And what does it talk about? I see him, but he's not far. A star will rise from Israel, etc., etc. That our sages interpret this couplet poem that he says to refer to King David and to the Mashiach. The question, therefore, is, if we're going to talk about Mashiach, which is that's the end game, that's what we're all working for, why are we speaking about the Mashiach in this portion? Moses should just come out and declare somewhere, even in the last portion of the week, before I die, and oh, by the way, I'm giving you all a blessing, and there's a general blessing, Mashiach is going to come, and this is what it's going to be like. Why does Bilaam, the evil dude, get to tell us, the Jewish people, that, oh, by the way, you're going to have a King David and there's going to be a Messianic era as well? Very interesting thing. Something which is very unique to Judaism. In that, the end of days, as it's referred to, the Messianic era, the coming of the Messiah, a state of paradise on earth. Jews believe that it's not just for Jews. When Messiah comes, it's going to be the Messiah for everybody, because there is only one God. There's only one earth. And we're all trying to make this planet the best it could possibly be, as it says in Hasidic philosophy, a dwelling place for God, a place where holiness can be conveyed in this ungodly, you should pardon the expression, place and sphere of existence.
But when the world achieves perfection, it's not going to be perfect only for the Jewish people. And had Moses said that Mashiach is coming, we would be led to believe, we get Mashiach and you guys get nothing, which is really the way most of the world's religions work. But here, that it's Bilam, a not Jewish person. And not only is he not Jewish, but he is the most evil dude who ever lived. Forget about all the people that you can come up with. This guy's more evil. This guy was the source of evil when it came to evil people. He's the one who said, there's going to be a messianic era. And it's going to be a time of absolute perfection and wonderful, all the above, which are mentioned later on in the prophets. Because there's only one God, and there's only going to be one messianic era. We got to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Would you like to get in touch with me? Easiest way, rabbifinman.com, www.rabbifinman.com. I appreciate all of the fan mail. I usually get to my fan mail on Sunday afternoon. So if you're just listening to the show now, and you sit down at the computer and type me out a letter, you're going to get an answer probably this afternoon. If you go to the middle of the week, you're probably going to get an answer next Sunday. So don't be discouraged if I didn't answer you right away. Sometimes I do get a chance to get to it, but I have to allot myself a certain amount of time because the Jewish Hour is not the only thing that I do. What else do I do? Well, there, you can see on the rabbifinman.com. We've got classes in Hasidic thought. There's the E-Parsha, the U-Parsha, the Hasidic use story, which are all different media of conveying Jewish ideals and insights, and hopefully an entertaining way on there. And of course, there's the very, very important donations page. It's the end of June. We're not even close. We need your help, folks. People here at WPON, they're very patient. I just went to the station manager before I started the show and said, I haven't got June. Hopefully we'll get June and July. Hopefully get June and July together. And he just gave me the thumbs up. I've been on this, we've been here since 2009 on this station specifically, and I didn't pay for a whole year's worth of showtime over here. We go month to month to month to month to month, and every week I come here and I just solicit your support, and thank God every month you come through, and you know who you are. And for those people who didn't come through, you know who you are too. Isn't it about time you went to your computer, went to rabbifinman.com, went on the donations page, and gave a donation to the Jewish Hour. It's a 501(c) corporation, which means you can deduct it from your taxes. It is a charitable organization according to Jewish law, which means you can take it off of your tithing, and therefore would be a source of great blessing to you and the entire world, because the Jewish Hour, now 18 years in existence, will be able to continue on into perpetuity, hopefully with till the coming of the Mashiach, the Messiah, which is imminently expected. And unfortunately, we are out of time. We want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. I hope to see you back again next week. Take care.
Mit welcher Feier reformen geht.